I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. COVID-19 has had a devastating effect on the U.S. workforce, with unemployment in the double digits. But it's women, in particular women of color, who've been hit the hardest by the crushing wave of job losses. So much so that some experts have begun calling this recession a she-cession. According to research by the National Women's Law Center, from February 2020 through October 2020, 2.2 million women left the workforce, and that accounts for more than half of all net job losses since the pandemic began. Compounding those losses is the lack of affordable quality childcare and a wage gap where women make significantly less than men. Today on The Takeaway, the economic future of women in the U.S. workforce. Jabeli Karazana is with me, an economy reporter for The 19th. Jabeli, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is C. Nicole Mason, the president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jabeli, why are we seeing so many more women than men losing their jobs? What are some of the biggest factors behind that disparity?
Yeah, what we saw this year was, I think, a little bit unusual when it comes to recessions in this country. You had the jobs that really lost work this year were jobs that were heavily concentrated with women workers. So hospitality, the public sector, education jobs, those are jobs that women dominate. And that's fairly unusual because typically in a recession, it's jobs that are dominated by men that are lost, like we saw in 2008, 2009, construction, manufacturing, male-dominated fields, right? And so this year was different in that it was fields dominated by women that really took a really big hit and are still struggling to come back.
And of course, we're talking about women of all backgrounds and different family structures have taken a hit. But there is something very specific happening with working mothers, Nicole. We are getting a lot of stories from working mothers on this topic. I want to play a call for you from Shayna, who called us to talk about some issues around childcare.
My name is Shayna. I'm a military spouse. I'm an older working mom now, but one of the reasons why I was a stay-at-home mom for so long when my kids were little is because there was no affordable, reliable, and safe childcare options. If I did get my kids into daycare, my entire paycheck went to pay for daycare. And then what's the point of working? I'm missing time with my family and I'm not making any money.
Nicole, how often have we heard stories like that in this pandemic?
Well, it's been really often, and it's actually reached a fever pitch since the start of the pandemic. The truth of the matter is that families can spend up to 30% of their income on care, and women are responsible for up to, you know, more than 30% of caretaking responsibilities in families. And so with the pandemic, women being, you know, working, continuing to work 40 hours a week, and with schools and daycares closed, it's created a double burden for working women. And if we're for families, for dual income families, if women are earning less because of pay inequity, they make an economic calculation for their families, and it's women who leave the workforce. And it's really important that to know that women are not just working to earn a living, but they're working because their careers bring them satisfaction. And so having to leave a career because they are struggling with care or caretaking responsibilities is a real blow to women's career advancement and other in mobility.
Right. It's not just a question of doing it because you have to. I mean, there are women who work because they have to. They don't have a choice. We should be clear that there is an array of different reasons, given the socioeconomic issues that this country often has presented and the inequities in wealth. But definitely the personal satisfaction and the fact that those things have to take a back seat for some women, and the fact that some women have even had to leave their jobs entirely, is playing out right now. Jabeli, what about the fact that some of these job losses, and from what we're understanding, the majority of them are focused for women of color?
Yeah, this pandemic has been unequal from the start, right? And that's no different in this story with women and the labor force. Latinas, Black women, those are the groups that continue to have really, really high unemployment rates. You know, you have in December when, you know, most women were around 6%, 6.3%. You had Latinas at 9.1%. You had Black women at 8.4% unemployment. And so even though a lot of jobs are coming back, these groups are still struggling more. And again, it's concentration in terms of where, what kinds of jobs they are in. It's occupational segregation historically that has put women of color in these jobs that are just a lot more sensitive to social distancing, closures. Again, a lot of those are hospitality jobs in particular. And so those jobs still haven't really come back in full force yet. And it's women of color that are suffering the most.
And do we know in terms of our percentage of working women in the workforce, how has it been historically this low?
No, it hasn't been historically this low for several decades. And that's what's really sort of disheartening about this entire story, because in December 2019, right before the pandemic, women had surpassed men as the largest part of the labor force for only the second time in history. It had only ever happened before in the previous recession, because again, so many men had lost their jobs. And so women had reached this point right before the start of this year where they were really getting to a point of a lot of upward mobility in the labor force. And so we have lost at least a decade of that progress in the first few months of the pandemic. We're starting to claw back a little bit now, but it still is going to have a really disastrous effect long term.
Nicole, one of the things that's happening is that our work lives and our home lives are colliding, and in many instances there just isn't a line between the two. I mean, I host this show not from a studio, but I host it from a closet in my apartment, and my child is often right on the other side of the door. For those of us who are doing this, whose work lives and child lives and mother lives are all colliding, does it hurt us? And I guess what I mean, Nicole, I should be more clear. Does it hurt us to be seen as mothers on the other side of the Zoom call?
I'm not sure it hurts us as being mothers on the other side of any Zoom call. I think that as a single mom to 11-year-old twins, I think the burden of having to juggle my full-time career and work, I'm feeling very fortunate to be able to work from home and also managing virtual school and also making sure that my kids are thriving is a burden that disproportionately women have to bear. I do feel that this is a burden that women have carried for a very long time, working women, and the pandemic has made it nearly impossible for us to sustain. And so what I'm, you know, what I like in this moment is that it's not only, you know, all women are struggling, working women are struggling with this, from corporate moms to moms who are on the front lines and grocery store clerks. We're all juggling care, which lets us know that this is a systemic and structural problem and not an individual problem, even though historically it's been framed that way.
And Nicole, you mentioned you're a single parent. I'm also a solo parent juggling a full-time job and childcare responsibilities. And it just feels like there really aren't any options or many options for women who are in that position, who are the sole heads of household right now.
Absolutely. So many of the stories that have come out have been about women leaving the workforce. And, you know, I get asked questions a lot about whether or not it's because, you know, they have two incomes or, you know, and I say that's absolutely not the case. I hear stories about women who are the primary breadwinner in their families, mainly many Black and Latino women who are making the choice to leave the workforce out of necessity rather than, you know, some economic comfort, or they have, you know, savings stocked away. And when we look at who the numbers in terms of who the pandemic has disproportionately impacted, these are women of color and lower wage jobs with few benefits, little flexibility. So when they have to leave the workforce, it's economically devastating.
Let's take a listen, Nicole, to a caller who described a situation, particularly when it comes to childcare, as a catch-22.
Hi, my name is Beth. I'm a working mom. I'm sort of in a catch-22. I would like to go and work more, but I can't because I have to stay home and watch my daughter. So I would like to put her in daycare so I could work more. But right now I can't afford daycare because I can't go work because I have to watch her at home.
That is just a circular crazy feeling, isn't it? I mean, it just feels like there is no way out, Nicole.
Mm-hmm. It does feel like there is no way out. And again, I think this moment is a moment for us to reimagine systems and structure. I think it's time for a national care infrastructure where we think about no woman, no family spending more than 7% of their income on care. I think it's time for us to really reimagine the social safety net. These are all things that advocates have been talking about for many decades, and women, again, have been juggling this catch-22 for some time now. So I think the pandemic has provided this opportunity for us to really think about what we might do differently and how we might better support working moms and families.
Chabelli, to that point, I mean, I wrote about this in the Washington Post recently, calling on the Biden-Harris administration to at least build something of a national child care system, which seems like a fantasy right now. But Chabelli, you're on the ground. What are people saying about that? Is there any policy initiative to do this? Is there any interest?
There is a lot of interest. And I think, you know, to Nicole's point, this has been something that advocates have been fighting for a long time. And now almost every family in America is dealing with it in some way. And so it's been really elevated in the public conversation on this topic. And so we know the Biden administration has set out a caregiving plan over 10 years, but in the shorter term, in his economic recovery plan, he has called for $25 billion to stabilize the industry just as a quick money for rent, utilities, payroll, so that daycare centers can open again. And that's in addition to $10 billion that Congress already allocated in December. You know, beyond that, there is discussion of changing the child tax credit to make it refundable, to make it monthly, so that families can access those dollars faster. And so there is a lot of discussions of solutions, and I expect to hear quite a bit about that in the coming weeks, because it really is an economic problem. If we cannot allow women to go back to work because they are stuck in these cycles with childcare, that's going to affect our economy really long term. We're already seeing it. You know, its assembly lines are slowed down because manufacturers are citing childcare specifically as the reason they can't retain workers, the reason they can't employ more workers.
Chabelli, how do childcare disparities affect women financially? I mean, we've talked a little bit about this catch-22 where it's too expensive to pay for childcare, but you need childcare if you're going to work, but you want to work, but you can't. It's sort of like, but what is the outcome ultimately with childcare disparities?
Well, I think it's a little bit of what you just said, right? It's extremely expensive. It's an industry on its own that is already struggling with really razor-thin margins to even stay open, which is why we're seeing what we're seeing now, where such mass closures of daycares all around the country. But it is a really large financial burden. And so that's why there has been some talk of sort of federal subsidized model or partially subsidized model, similar to what other countries in Europe have, because it is just so, so expensive for families to get in there to begin with, to find quality care, especially if you're a low-wage worker. I mean, I've been speaking to low-wage workers who are essential workers who are just in this impossible decision where I can't find it. If I find it, I can't afford it. And I can't lose my job. I'm in an essential field. I mean, it's been really impossible for a lot of mothers with the childcare piece.
Finding it is hard. Finding it and being accepted into a program is hard. And then finding it being accepted into a program that works for the working hours that many women have is even harder. And then affording it is even harder. I think many people, Nicole, are surprised at how much childcare can actually cost, but it's often more than what many people pay for a mortgage. Isn't that right?
Yes. Like I said, about women and families can spend up to 30% or more for care. And, you know, we're not even talking about high quality care. The quality can be inconsistent. And so when we think about, you know, lower wage moms or families or single parent moms, not being able to afford care really impacts whether or not they can re-enter the workforce. And what we're seeing in the pandemic is the uncertainty caused by precarious childcare and schools closing is making it impossible for women to plan for the future, to plan when they can re-enter the workforce. And so as a result of that, you know, the economic impact of the pandemic on, you know, women, their labor force participation will continue. And so having and creating a fix, not 10 years from now, I do not think we have 10 years for, you know, to come up with the child care infrastructure or care infrastructure. And I have to say, we've been thinking about state level solutions and putting it on ballots similar to other ballot referendums, because we believe, for example, if child care was on the ballot in 2020, it would have passed unanimously.
Because it almost made it to the ballot, Nicole, because Senator Elizabeth Warren at the time in her run for president mentioned this a couple of times as far as childcare being part of the infrastructure of the American workforce. And yet here we are.
Yes, here we are. I think that at the federal level, it's going to take some time for us to wind through, you know, thinking through a really robust care infrastructure. But at the state level, we've seen issues like same-sex marriage, marijuana legalization, paid sick leave that have started off as ballot measures in states and have passed. And so that is a path forward for thinking about building a, you know, care infrastructure and some fixes. And I also think businesses and, you know, companies and corporations in the private sector also have a role to play.
Trigvelli, let's talk a little bit about the economic impact if women do not return to the workforce. I've argued that we need women to participate in the economy. That's the only way our economy works. So, Trigvelli, how essential is it to getting women back into the workforce to rebuild our economy?
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely essential. I mean, you're talking about half of the workforce, right? And just look at this year. The majority of essential workers were women. What would we have done had those women not have a pathway? And I mean, and I guess we're seeing it right now, right, of what it looks like when they don't have a pathway to work, when it's disrupted. And so when you're thinking long term, we talked a little bit about the gender pay gap at the start of the show. You know, the gender pay gap is expected to widen as a result of what we're seeing right now. And that's because women are out of work. It might take them months, maybe years, to return to the workforce. And what that does is skills depreciate. You tend to come back in a lesser position, not at the same pay, perhaps. And so what that does for the gender pay gap is it's likely going to widen it. And we're expecting to take maybe 3-5 years before we get back to where we were even before the pandemic with this pay gap that is still, you know, 82 cents, women making 82 cents on the dollar.
And that's white women making 82 cents on the dollar. Women of color make significantly less. Latinas almost make 50 something cents, black women 60 some odd cents. So when we incorporate race into the equation, it changes. Nicole, to that point, just one thing I want to get in before we wrap here, we've got about a little bit over a minute left, is there is also an emotional labor element here. Women are being asked to do so many things. And on top of that, now we're being tasked with finding vaccine appointments for our parents, for example. I mean, it seems like there is an emotional burden here that's going to take a long time to heal.
I agree. I think women in this moment have really taken on a tremendous emotional, psychological, financial burden in trying to hold all these things together. What I'm, again, you know, ending on a optimistic note is that for many of us, we've suffered in silence and sort of internalized all the things that we weren't able to juggle. And what we know now is that it's not just us. It's not just me. Women are struggling. And so what that means to me is that it's not an individual problem. It's a structural, systemic problem that we can work together collectively to solve.
See, Nicole Mason is the president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And Trigvelli Carazana is an economy reporter for the 19th. Thanks to you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As we just heard, the pandemic has had a disproportionately hard financial impact on women nationwide, particularly women of color. And we wanted to hear from you on this. If you're a working mom, what help do you need in the short and long term? And what government support do you want to see?
This is Laura in St. Paul, Minnesota. I think that there's been this notion that flexibility is going to solve working mothers' problems. And as somebody who is now experiencing comparatively a lot of flexibility with my time, I'll just say I'm working all the time. There's no such thing as balance. There's no such thing as stopping and stepping away. Sad, right? Because we'd like to have lives that are fuller and richer. And the idea, I think, that flexibility was going to be the answer for working mothers is proving false. So what I'd like to see is better structures around ensuring that flexibility doesn't come back to disadvantage working mothers.
I am a working mom. I work 4 days a week and my husband does work 3 days a week. So we are incredibly lucky that we are making ends meet while our children are able to go to school and have childcare most of the time, period. I think that having the ability to use the stimulus money for childcare will be great. And I think it should be not all in one chunk, but perhaps $500 a month would be a nice way to spread it out over time so that we could make it work better for our families.
Hi, this is Jana from Athens, Ohio. I'm an associate professor at a university and the mother of three girls who are ages 8, 5, and 18 months. What I need now more than anything financially is time and sleep. My kids have been doing school remotely since last March. My husband has depression and is out of work and is often unavailable. I'm often left to take care of the kids, help them with their schoolwork, prepare meals, clean the house, do the laundry, and try to do my job. I need schools to be open and to be safe full-time. I also need childcare for my youngest. I'd also like to see an increase in financial support to mental health resources, particularly for individuals and areas who are in rural United States.
As a working mom, in the short term, I need a nap. Long term, I would love to have more equity in my house, in the division of labor between childcare and household duties. Honestly, they're both about equally as likely to happen, which is not at all. If I were to receive a stimulus check, I would have the luxury of being able to put it into long-term savings or doing some major project around the house. It would not be something that I would rely on to pay my mortgage or put food on the table or keep the utilities on. I know that's not the case for every working mother out there.
My name is Christina and I live in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm a working professional. I have a master's degree and I have a child. I'm one of what has apparently become a large group of people whose spouses left them during the pandemic because apparently they don't like us anymore. And unfortunately, he also left me with a massive debt problem. So honestly, the thing that is standing between my fairly good income and the life I should be able to give my child is that debt, and stimulus payments will go directly towards that debt.
Hi, this is Katrina from Maplewood, New Jersey. A year later, I am finding that the savings are getting lower and the income is still there, but I think it's just the stress. What could I use? I could just use a break. Even if it were a little bit of stimulus money to pay for something not required, but just fine is starting to feel a little bit not fine.
As a working mom myself, I hear many of you, and I really thank you for sharing your stories with us. We want to keep hearing from working mothers on the support you need right now, so please get in touch by recording a voice memo and sending it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us to record your answer straight into your computer or phone.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Just weeks into the Biden administration, actions from the Kremlin are putting U.S.-Russia relations in the spotlight. Over the past week, thousands of Russians have been arrested for protesting in support of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
On Tuesday, Navalny was sentenced to 2 years and 8 months in prison. A court found that he had violated the terms of a 2014 conviction by traveling to Germany last year to recover from nerve agent poisoning. Navalny has said that President Putin was behind that poisoning, an allegation that the Kremlin has denied. This despite a conversation between President Joe Biden and President Putin last week, where Biden asked that Navalny be released. I'm joined now by Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist and staff writer at The New Yorker. Masha, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your reaction to Navalny's sentencing and what this means between the for the battle between Putin and Navalny?
The sentence was perfectly expected at this point, and this despite the sentence being illegal. I mean, he is Navalny got a suspended sentence in this completely trumped up case. He complied with the terms of the suspended sentence. But meanwhile, the European Court on Human Rights, which by Russian law is the top appellate court in the Russian court system, right, the European Court on Human Rights, actually threw this case out, saying that it was politically motivated. So I know this is a little difficult for Americans to imagine that an international court could have this kind of power. But it's kind of like, you know, if there were a court case in Massachusetts, it had gone all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had ruled that the case had no merit. And then Massachusetts said, oh, whatever, we're going to send the guy to jail anyway. The case is trumped up. The sentence was already served. There were no parole violations. So basically, this is retaliation for Navalny's surviving the poisoning.
Well, and now Navalny and Putin have a, at least from observers are saying that a lot of this is because of Putin's shock and surprise that Navalny is actually getting the level of support that he has gotten from Russians. Is that right?
I think that gets it a little backwards. Navalny survived an assassination attempt carried out by the Russian secret police. And then decided to return to Russia, which is something that shocked the Kremlin, right? People don't usually come back to Russia after an assassination attempt. In fact, the Kremlin has been very effective at keeping people out of the country by threatening them with criminal prosecution, which is, of course, the second thing they did, was they basically told Navalny that if he came back to Russia, he would be arrested, which is exactly what happened. So, and the protests broke out after his arrest.
So was Navalny's coming back in a way attempting to call Putin's bluff?
Navalny simply refused to be a political exile. He thinks of himself as a Russian politician.
And Putin has, how has Putin handled protests historically? Because we know that thousands of Russians have been arrested so far.
This is the largest crackdown that we have seen. Putin has always been afraid of protest and has always arrested people in response. But the thousands of people, you know, over the course of 2 weeks, thousands and thousands and thousands is unprecedented.
Masha, President Biden got on a call with Vladimir Putin and told him that he had concerns over Navalny's imprisonment. And yet they imprisoned him anyway. What does that tell us already about the tone of the relationship between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin?
Well, this doesn't really tell us anything new. Remarkably, in the Kremlin readout of the call, there was no mention of Navalny. But, the Putin administration has been impervious to international pressure since the beginning. The Biden administration is different from other U.S. administrations in that this is the first administration since the Cold War that has not come in promising the American people that it will improve relations with Russia, which I think is a great sign. It's a great sign of realism. And I hope it's also a sign that, you know, it's a great sign of realism just because it's impossible at this point to improve Russian-American relations. But I also think it's a sign that this administration understands it's morally wrong to strive to improve relations with a dictatorship.
Now, is that, Masha, because of 4 years of the Trump presidency and what that did to U.S.-Russia relations, which I think we should talk a little bit about? Is the Biden administration sort of responding to that as well?
I'm not sure. Probably it made it easier for the Biden administration to not focus on improving relations with Russia because Trump so discredited the very idea of improving relations with Russia. I mean, despite all of Trump's rhetoric, the Russian-American relations actually continued their long-time nosedive during the Trump administration, right? There was no improvement. But the Trump administration certainly did not put any pressure on Russia or on any other international human rights violator to stop violating human rights. The Biden administration, in this sense, is returning to the traditional American policy of at least reminding these dictatorships that they're violating their obligations.
Does Vladimir Putin have a long-term plan for dealing with Alexei Navalny and his followers at this point? Or is this the wait and see, we'll put him in jail and then we'll decide what to do after that?
I don't think Vladimir Putin has a long-term plan about anything ever. I used to think by watching him and sort of, you know, calculating the amount of time that it took him to think about something that he had a planning horizon of 6 weeks. But it seems to have shortened. But Navalny, I don't think they believed that he was going to come back to Russia, even though he had said to the media, he had said in an interview with me, for example, that he was definitely going to return to Russia when he was done recovering from the poisoning. But they scrambled to try to scare him away when he actually announced that he was coming back. So it was all cooked up in the course of days. They diverted his plane to a different airport to avoid protesters on 8 minutes' notice. They took him to a police precinct and had a fake trial inside a police precinct to be able to keep him under arrest. This is kind of seat of your pants way of dealing with Navalny. And as for protesters, they're responding with a large-scale crackdown. They're arresting thousands of people. They don't even have anywhere to put the people that they have arrested. So one of the most horrifying details of the last few days is that hundreds of people who were arrested over the weekend in St. Petersburg and Moscow, overall there were arrests in 90 different cities, but in those big cities were arrests numbered in the many hundreds, 40 hours after they were first detained, they were still in unheated police vans parked outside of detention centers waiting in line to be admitted. People had not received any food. They were not allowed to leave the van to go to the bathroom. So these are torture conditions, but they also tell us just how little planning, logic, strategy, anything is in this crackdown. But I think that what Putin is doing is he has always been afraid of protest. He has always, I think, had this almost magical idea that he could somehow be dislodged by protest. But now he has been watching Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus, who basically does not care that his entire country has been marching in protest for 5 months. People have been arrested. People have been tortured. In Belarus, several thousand people, it's now been documented, have been subjected to torture. And yet people keep coming out to protest. And nothing happens. Lukashenko just, he has no legitimacy, but he just refuses to leave office. And that has to have been a kind of inspiring example to Putin, who realizes he doesn't have to react to these protests with anything other than brute force.
Masha, in terms of the U.S.-Russia relationship going forward, that Navalny is just one piece of this. As we look at, for example, the first year, potentially under the first 100 days, even under the Biden administration, what are some of the priorities that you see for our Russian envoys and our strategy with Russia right now?
Relations with Russia are clearly not a priority for the Biden administration, which I think is understandable because this is an area in which progress is all but impossible. There is an arms treaty that was signed. I think this was the only sort of positive item on the Russia agenda. And other than that, the Biden administration really has to consider what it's going to do about Navalny, about Russian interference in American politics. So there are a number of sanctions questions on under consideration. There are also sanctions that basically have to kick in almost automatically because of the use of chemical weapons. And so the real question is the Biden administration going to sort of choose harsher measures or milder ones? The logic of using milder measures is if it hopes that it can somehow influence Putin's behavior, Putin's policies. I don't think it has any illusions about that. So I'm kind of hoping that they're looking at harsher sanctions because at least they're the right thing to do. We know we can't influence Putin, but we can take a moral stand.
Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist and staff writer at The New Yorker. Masha, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Last week on the show, we discussed the tweet I sent out about, quote, the pandemic wall I was hitting from the burnout of parenting during the pandemic, without proper childcare, constant workflow, nonstop news, and social isolation. And the response to that tweet was overwhelming. I'm far from the only one suffering right now. Thousands of you say you've also hit that wall. And while it seems counterintuitive to do less right now, my next guest says there's lots of power in resting. Catherine May is a writer and author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catherine, we're tired. Very tired. It's been, we thought 2020 was going to kind of end and things, but it's not letting up. 2021 has a lot of similar energy as 2020.
Yeah.
A lot of people are using the word burnout, but you use a concept called wintering. What is wintering?
So wintering is the idea that throughout our lives, we have these moments when we kind of fall through the cracks. So that might be, I mean, I never wrote the book to predict a pandemic, but it might be because of some kind of a life event. It might be mental or physical illness. But however it comes along, it's this really unpleasant time in our life, but it's also this crucible of change. And it's often the place where we begin to really rethink our priorities and wonder about the next phase for us.
And could that be something that we do alone? Is it something, when I was reading parts of the book, I kept thinking, this is almost like saying, it's okay to say I'm not okay right now.
Oh, absolutely. And I honestly think that particularly at this stage in the game, as you say, we're burnt out, we've hit a wall. It is so important for us to be able to say, I am not okay with any of this, because it isn't okay. And I think as you were pointing out before, it's particularly not okay for parents who have dived in to rescue absolutely everything right now. You know, we're doing childcare, we're doing schooling, we are trying to work full-time jobs, we're worrying about older relatives, we're worrying about our own health. It's a very, very heavy burden to carry. And that doesn't mean to say it's going to go away, but I don't think we do ourselves any favors at all if we try and pretend that everything's fine and just whistle through it.
So what does wintering entail, first of all? And second of all, does it only happen in the winter, or is that a concept that you created?
No, absolutely. Wintering can happen at any time in the year. Although I do think that sometimes in the actual winter, the seasonal winter, it can be particularly bad. I mean, I think we're all feeling restricted at the moment as well, not only because of pandemic stuff, but also because the weather's keeping us indoors. You know, there's no opportunity to relax and kick back. I think at least in the summer, it maybe felt a little bit like we had some fun options. All the fun options are gone. But the kind of character of winter is this big cocktail of emotions, really. There's a lot of loneliness and isolation, frustration, boredom, feeling kind of left out, feeling like everybody else is carrying on and we're not. I mean, I think at least in a pandemic, we maybe all feel in the same boat. But even then, I think there's a sense that when we're doing this all individually, we're not in this together because we can't be. And that's what's making this particularly hard.
So how does one begin to get into a wintering phase? Let's say we've hit the wall, we're burned out, we're standing on the precipice of who knows what at this point. What do you recommend? You're saying that people should actually lean into that feeling? They should do less, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a time to take enormous care of yourself. You know, we've been banding this self-care phrase about for a while, and it's been diluted to mean something quite kind of commercial, you know, like have a nice bubble bath, buy yourself a scented candle. The roots of self-care come from the disability movement, and they are so relevant to all of us at the moment, because what we need to do is meet our own needs, which is something that we so often fail to do. And that means adjusting our priorities right now. We cannot do everything. That is, I mean, I think we've busted that myth a while ago. I hope we have, because it simply isn't possible to carry on with every element of our lives as normal, and something has to give. And if it doesn't, it's us who give. It's our health that suffers. It's our mental health. It's our family relationships. So this is a time to radically reprioritize what we can possibly do. And, you know, that counts for employers too. They've got to begin to really listen to people about the strain they're under right now. But yeah, we cannot do everything. The kids will be okay as long as we look after their mental health. They will catch up with the stuff at school. They will manage without knowing, you know, the sort of intricacies of algebra this year or whatever it is
Catherine,
we're trying
Catherine,
to teach
I have to stop you. You sound like you're telling people to do less and to be okay with that. You're telling Americans to do that?
Oh my goodness, we have that same problem in Britain too.
Okay, so
worry.
It's across the pond. So you're telling people to do a radical thing, which is relax.
Yeah, I mean, I think relax might be a bit of a tall order at the moment, to be honest, but to actively rest if we can. And that means, you know, not pushing ourselves not to get enough sleep, for example, to try and fit more in, like prioritizing stuff like taking 5 minutes to read a book, you know, walking around the block if we can. I've got so many friends who are parents at the moment who are not leaving the house because they just feel so under pressure. And actually, I think if we can take 15 minutes a day to prioritize our own health, we're going to survive this a lot better. And yeah, you know, Americans need to learn it and the Brits need to learn it too. This is a moment that we're being taught something.
Now, I guess the one thing I would say is that a lot of people might be confused about how to do that or whether they should do that. It almost feels like you're saying that we should have some compassion for ourselves when we're in, again, these are mind-blowing concepts for, I think, a lot of people who just go. And you might even be suggesting that we are a little bit easier on ourselves in this moment.
I know. I love the incredulity in your voice there.
I'm trying to get this into my head, but I think it's wonderful.
It is time. You know, we, over the last 30, 40 years, have pushed ourselves harder and harder and filled in every single little hole and corner in the day. You know, even when we have a moment of downtime, we pick up our phones and before we know it, we're in our emails and there's another task in our mind. Like, you cannot keep going like this. None of us can. And it is time for us all to learn to compromise, to accept that, God forbid, we are not perfect, and to accept that actually we're not in control of events right now. There's no route or behavior that will make this all okay. And actually, when you surrender to that idea, it kind of lets you off the hook a bit. You know, this is not within the force of your will to master it and get on top of it. Instead, we need to soften and allow ourselves the experience of failing a little bit.
You said that. Oh my. Catherine May, changing lives here. Catherine May is the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, thank you so much for that message.
Thank you and good luck.
That's all we have for this Wednesday, folks. We're halfway to the weekend. Really appreciate you all tuning in. And of course, if you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet at The Takeaway and I'm at Tanzina Vega. We can also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253 and leave us your take there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back tomorrow.